kinds of things related to hydrologic and climatological conditions related to drought.
Thank you. I know you guys do a great job. What a fun year, huh? Representative Roebling, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Chair. And I think Representative Boquist kind of asked this before, and that is the conditions you mentioned for wheat, i.e. current rain, is also ideal for brush and other kinds of fire hazard materials in eastern Oregon as well. So do we see that as happening this year? And then the prediction earlier was that we're going to start getting dry again. So we're going to get this boost right now and then dry conditions to dry it out.
Chair Smith, Representative Roebling, I'm probably not the best person to talk about that as fire danger goes, but it is an issue. It has been an issue in the past, and when you start talking rangeland conditions and the like, of course, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, gets much more into that, and I have really not heard much from them as of yet into this drought season, but that's something we're going to have to talk to them about.
Thank you. Representative Sumner, did you have a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you foresee any critical shortages in municipal water supplies? Are any cities going to be closing the taps?
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, again, this is going to be all second or third hand. I don't work in that area, but from what I was seeing last week from the Corps of Engineers with the Corps of Engineers reports on the Willamette, it's looking like again with the reservoirs filling like they have at least on the west side, it's going to be one of those years where they think they're going to be able to make that, but that could change so fast. I haven't heard anything on the east side. Perhaps Mr. Gorman, you know, might have some information on that if he's, you know, would like to come up.
Thank you.
Would you like him to come up? Representative Sumner, would you like him to come up and answer that?
I'd like somebody to address that question.
Kyle Gorman, are you here? We'll put you on the hot seat. Hi, and welcome. Thank you.
I'm
glad I called you.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Gorman. I'm the region manager for the South Central region of the Oregon Water Resources Department. My region covers the Deschutes Basin, the Klamath Basin, and the Lake Basin. So some of the topics that we've talked about touch in my area, and welcome to Central Oregon for some of you. Your question about municipal supply, the majority of, from what I know, at least in the region that I work in, the South Central region, the municipalities rely on groundwater. And for information that I am aware of, most of the municipalities will be okay for this year. There will be declines in groundwater levels in their wells, but they're not forecasting any severe shortages or shortages to the degree that will be a shortage for the citizens of the towns and the cities. The city of Bend does rely on Tumalo Creek for municipal water, but they do have wells for backup supply, so they should be in good shape this year.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Gorman? Any other questions for the panel? Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. I'm going to close the informational meeting, and we're going to. Before I go any further, I wanted to introduce Patrick Brennan, which I failed to do. My committee administrator and Janine Zeev do the video, and without these two people, this committee wouldn't function. I got to tell you, so puts us all together and gets us here. With that, I think we're going to do a public hearing on House Bill 2729. I'll open the public hearing. And Patrick, you want to talk a little bit about it while Representative Burley gets...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2729, as you mentioned, was sponsored by Representative Burley. It authorizes cities and counties to create community forest authorities, specifies the makeup, duties, and powers of those authorities, authorizes them to issue revenue bonds or other revenue obligations to acquire and maintain private forest lands, and there is an emergency clause in the bill so that it would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. This bill has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue, and as such, will not receive a fiscal or revenue impact statement on the measure.
Thank you, Patrick. Representative Burley is with us, our committee member, who is sponsoring this bill along with some other people. So I think you can go ahead with whatever you want us to know.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity for this hearing on House Bill 2729. I am Chuck Burley, Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54. Along with Representative Gene Wisnett and Senator Ben Westland, co-sponsored this bill. And this bill was introduced last session. It was rather late in the session, got a couple hearings. And this draft right now for this session basically picks up where that one left off. With me today is Mr. Tom Tuckman to my left, and to my far left, Mr. John Shelk. I've asked them to come up here because they'll be able to explain in greater detail what the bill does and some of the reasons for this bill. But I'd like to make some comments here for the record before they get started. As you know, the forest products industry has undergone significant changes over the past 15 years or more in Oregon, and much of this is due to federal forest policies. But as a result, in the past few years, we've seen here in eastern Oregon two of the largest industrial forest landowners change hands, leaving the future of these large contiguous blocks of working forest in question. In a report last year titled Land Use Change on Non-Federal Land in Eastern Oregon, the Department of Forestry reported some startling statistics. Since 1975 in Central Oregon, the area of low-density residential uses has increased by 86% and the urban area by 137%. And the highest rates of change in dominant land use over the past 26 years has occurred in Central Oregon and Klamath County, and most of the dominant land use changes are coming out of both forest and agricultural use. Recently, and I believe Mr. Shelk will elaborate on this, we've seen several large blocks of industrial forest land bought by private interests and, for all intents and purposes, taking out of a working forest scenario. And by large blocks, I'm talking 30,000, 40,000 acres or bigger. Now, make no mistake, I would prefer to see these lands that are currently private industrial forest lands remain as such. But the trend that we're seeing right now is that that's not the case, and that's what causes me some concern, and that's why I agreed to sponsor this bill. I'd like to make just a few key points here before I turn the microphone over to these gentlemen. First of all, this bill does not mandate that anybody has to do anything. All it does is provide an opportunity if a community or a group of people wanted to pursue this. Second, this bill does not result in more lands in public ownership. As I said, this bill provides an opportunity for local ownership and local control. The concept of this bill is that the lands would have to remain as a working forest to provide commodity products as well as the resource values that we all prize, including fish and wildlife habitat, clean air, clean water, and access for recreation and other types of uses. But the key here is that under this concept, the forest lands have to remain as working forest lands. They have to provide a product that would generate the revenue to pay off the debt. It would also pay whatever taxes are applicable. It would pay for the operating expenses. And any revenues in excess of all that would remain with a local community for schools, roads, whatever the case may be. This bill is modeled after the Hospital Financing Authority, which is found in the Oregon Revised Statutes in Chapter 441, Sections 525 through 595. So this is not an entirely new concept. It's new in the fact that we're taking something that's been done and applying it to forest lands, but it's been around for a long time as far as hospital financing is concerned. But I want to close here by saying very, very clearly, this bill does not result in any additional public land ownership, nor would it result in any municipality, city, county, or otherwise, assuming any additional debt. This is just one more tool in the toolbox to help keep large blocks of working forest land in that scenario instead of having it broken up into parcels. Once we start losing these blocks of land, we'll never get them back. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to these gentlemen.
Any questions for Representative Burley? I don't think yet. Would you like to just stay there?
I may.
We'll
I'm John Shelp, Motco Lumber Company in Prineville, and welcome to God's country. Our company's been in business for about 75 years east of the Cascades. We're timberland owners. We recently had to shut down two of our sawmills in Prineville for lack of resource, specifically timber. At one point in 1980, there were five sawmills in Prineville. There are now none. So that gives you an idea of the severity of forest products industry and the situation that they're under east of the Cascades. Most of our land over here that we depend upon is national forest land. That's largely been drawn out of production through various decisions in Congress primarily. We've had to depend more and more on the private industrial lands and non-industrial lands east of the Cascades. We still have one mill operating in John Day, and that mill is dependent right now primarily on private timber. Some state of Idaho timber, but there's virtually no national forest timber being sold east of the Cascades in Oregon. That's why this is so important. We very badly need for the economy of this region to retain the various mills that still exist east of the Cascades. Communities like John Day have very, very little opportunity for outside economic development. Intel's not going to open a new chip plant in John Day next week. And by the same token, the people in John Day, it's just the nature of these folks that they're not going to pick up stakes and move to Portland to look for a job. So what happens when somebody loses an $18 an hour mill job with the pension and benefits, health benefits that go along with that, is that they end up moving in with their in-laws and poaching deer and cutting firewood for a living. And that's not the American dream, believe me. In the last 10 years, we've seen about 300,000 acres of private industrial timberland change hands east of the Cascades. That has gone into a variety of ownerships. But essentially what's happened is that some of the non-traditional, a non-traditional owner has stepped in and purchased that land from someone in general who's managed that land for sustained yield use for 60, 70, 80 years. They've heavily cut the timberland, and then they've put it out for sale. And inevitably, it's after a considerable length of time has gone by and no industrial owners have purchased that, it's been chopped up into smaller parcels, sold to a variety of different people with a variety of different ideas in mind. But inevitably, these are not people who are interested in operating this as timberland. So essentially, we've lost, at this point, 300,000 acres. The risk that we have right now is that there's probably close to another 600,000 acres that is kind of on the auction block right now or will be very shortly. This is land that, unlike western Oregon forest land, grows at, in some cases, a fifth the rate of western Oregon forest land. So the economics of investing in this for a timber company often are not compelling. So they will end up not investing in some of this land that is cut over, or in many cases is remote to another company's facilities. Keep in mind that at one time we had mills in Burns, Baker City, Long Creek, Pendleton, Bend, Redmond. They're gone. They just don't exist anymore. So you've got further and further distances to haul that timber, and it makes it less and less economical. And given the holding costs of some of this timber, it makes it no longer practical for industrial landowners to bid on this. So what we're seeing is many cases of these parcels being broken up, used for other things other than timber management. A good example of this, a real poster child right now, is the Crown Pacific parcel called the Bull Springs Tree Farm, just outside of Bend. There, it's just west of Bend as you move up toward the Cascades. It's just an it's an excellent example of urban interface encroaching on productive timberland. There have been a number of parcels on the Bull Springs parcel tree farm that originally belonged to Brooks Scanlon, moved down through several ownerships, currently belongs to some creditors that took over Crown Pacific's bankruptcy. There is a real pressure right now to break this off into 160-acre parcels. If it gets broken off into 160-acre parcels, you're going to see gentleman farms. You're going to see recreational parcels. You're not going to see that land managed as timberland. Now, that has a number of ramifications for wildlife, because every time somebody picks up 160 acres, inevitably they have to run a bunch of horses or cattle or llama or one thing and another on it, and it certainly is not conducive to wildlife management, among other things. It increases the risk of forest fire because you've got people doing a variety of activities on there, occasionally one house or more, and all of the problems you run into with urban forest interface occur to a much larger degree there. So with that, the activity that we're the bill that we're proposing, and several of you will recognize me from last session. this is not my career. I do have a day job. What we're suggesting here is something that with no obligation to counties, municipalities, creates a management authority that would allow this management authority, after the land has been generally rejected by timber companies, by other industrial entities, would allow an authority to pick this property up and manage it for timberland. So with that, I'll be quiet and answer any questions that you might have. Otherwise, turn it over to Tom.
I think we'll go ahead with Tom, and then I think we have questions. Thank you.
Great. Madam Chair, my name is Tom Tuckman. I'm president of U.S. Forest Capital. We're a small forestry and financial services company based in Portland, Oregon. We specialize in helping landowners fix their environmental challenges and monetizing conservation value. I want to thank you for having this hearing today. I also want a special thanks to Representative Burley for his leadership on this bill, along with Representative Wisnett and Senator Westland as well. We've heard a little bit about what the problem is. I'll add a couple of points there, talk more specifically about our, if you will, our tool and how it help manages the problem, and then talk briefly or summarize briefly the points in my written testimony that I think was handed out on some of the benefits that we think it has for Oregonians. Both Representative Burley and Mr. Shelk talked about the changes going on specifically in Oregon, but they're not unique to Oregon. In preparing for this hearing, I took a list of all the industrial timberland transactions that have taken place over the last 10 years. And it's amazing. 50%, about 35 million out of 70 million acres of industrial timberland, which is defined as land owned greater than 1,000 acres owned by industrial landowners, has changed hands in the last 10 years nationwide. And a proportion of that has been in the Northwest and in Oregon, especially in the last 2 years. And it's being driven, in addition to the environmental issues that Representative Burley pointed out, to macroeconomic changes in the industry. More specifically, timberland owners used to look at forest land as supply for their mills. In the 80s, that began to change as they're called TIMOs. It's an acronym meaning Timber Investment Management Organizations, started investing in timberland as an independent asset class. And the returns, which were approaching 20% in the 1990s, have made timber as an asset class, investor class, very popular, not only with pension funds and high net worth individuals, but international investors. And so there are literally billions of dollars chasing timber as an independent asset class. And that's driving traditional landowners that held these properties, as Mr. Shelk described, to sell off that asset, monetize it in the business, and take that money and redeploy it to other purposes. And so it's had huge changes, and it's creating huge changes in this country. In Oregon, when we were here a couple years ago, we were talking about the potential for it. Well, indeed, Boise Cascade changed hands, Crown Pacific, Longbell, Kanzua, some properties on the west side as well have all changed hands just in the last 24 months. And so we expect these changes to continue. And we also expect, based on these new landowners, and by the way, I'm not putting a judgment on any of this. They have the right to do this. It's their property. But what we expect those landowners to do is to increase harvest under state and federal law to maximize returns in the short term, and then carve out properties to enhance returns. And what this does is, in addition to creating the change, it also fragments the forest. The fragmentation of the forest impacts the ability to operate. You have not in my backyard issues. You have economies of scale issues. You have issues like Mr. Shelk's mills. Where's my supply coming from? And so it just exacerbates some of the issues that are going on in federal lands. And so for these reasons, plus the fact that the public or segments of the public still want to see private lands protected for the conservation benefits provide, have in our minds, my company's mind, created a need for a new kind of a tool. And we sort of have lofty goals. We want it to be non-regulatory. We want it to be willing seller. Want it to be market versus public financed. And we want it to afford real conservation gains. Those are things that everybody wants, but usually when you get down to a transaction, they often become controversial and difficult choices often have to be made. But what we've done is work with folks like Mr. Shelk and the conservation community and county commissioners and others to tap into the municipal finance market. And more specifically, our concept works as follows, and this is a very general summary of something that's a little bit more complex, but what we do is work with landowners or communities to put together private, nonprofit forestry companies or boards. Those bodies enter into willing negotiations with a private landowner, typical of any private transaction. They agree on price. That price is based on a prediction of how much timber can be harvested. And then they go to what's called an issuing authority or conduit authority to issue the debt on their behalf. And I'll get back to that in a second because that's specifically what this bill does. They take the proceeds from that debt issuance and they pay the seller, and then they take title to the property, and then they harvest trees under their sustainable forest management plan to service the debt. In its simplest form, that's what our community forestry bond financing tool does. In Washington and California, where we've been working on these types of transactions, the issuing authority, which is the body that, again, serves as the conduit between the underwriter community and the actual borrower, in this case the private nonprofit, they already have the authority to create those issuing authorities in Washington and California. In Oregon, we do not. That's what this bill does. What this bill does is create an issuing authority, it allows a municipality, a city or a county, to create an issuing authority comprised of business, conservation, local opinion leaders, to issue debt on behalf of one of these buyers. If all this other stuff works out, meaning there's a willing seller, you've got your valuation in a place that allows you to service your debt, you've achieved your public purpose. We believe that for certain transactions like hospitals where the private sector will not or cannot invest for forestry purposes, it allows a local community to keep large-scale working forests working, to use a little bit of a sound bite, I guess. And we think it provides a number of benefits. For the landowner community and businesses, property rights are maintained. All these transactions are voluntary, willing seller, willing buyer. Landowner liquidity is enhanced. That's very advantageous to a lot of landowners. It's enhanced and also maintains timber supply. We can do timber supply agreements with mills. Timber operations will be facilitated because, again, they're maintained in large-scale working forests. Collaborative forums will be created, and I don't want to underemphasize that. What we do is put different groups that historically have fought together around a table to develop a management plan. And it's pretty amazing when everybody has a stake in a 50,000 acre, 100,000 acre forest, where they know they can't go to another body and complain about it, whether it's judicial or legislative. They have to reach agreement themselves on how to manage the forest and finance that. It's amazing the kinds of agreements that get made, and they're done in a very positive way. It protects the environment, of course, because these forest lands are conserved for all their ecological and biological attributes. And also, the conservation community has a place at the table. Finally, from a community standpoint, these transactions, community officials will have the responsibility to appoint members to their issuing authority, which provides them an opportunity to have a say in how this debt will be used. But there is no, I want to be clear, there's no recourse to that issuing authority. In other words, God forbid, something goes wrong and they can't service their debt, the land does not go to the issuing authority. The land goes to the bondholders, and it'll probably sold again on the commercial market. But from a public purpose standpoint, it allows them to have a say. These transactions, as Representative Burley mentioned, could be structured to fund probably midterm and long term as debt service is paid down, to fund an array of local needs, schools, roads, etc. Community officials will be facilitators among constituents instead of being judges, as many folks are being asked to play. Environmental compliance is enhanced. There's a considerable lessening of the burdens on local government. Local taxes, again, as Representative Burley said, and employment are going to be generated from these properties. And the bulk of acquisition costs are borne not by a governmental entity, but by the private market. Municipal finance market issues about $150 billion annually pulled from the private sector to fund these types of public purpose type acquisitions. So that, again, I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for your time today and for considering House Bill 2729. We'll take questions.
Thank you. Representative Roblin has a question.
Actually, a few of them.
Yeah. We'll do the follow-up thing.
We appoint this board, they get funding authority, they go out and get bonds, they buy the property. The bonds are 25 to 50-year bonds. They get paid off. At that point, there is no necessity for them to continue to harvest that land. Is that true? I mean, they could just leave it and not have any harvesting going on at all, if the board so desired.
If the board so desired, technically that's true, although these boards are, first of all, the issuing authority, which is going to issue the debt on behalf, is going to be comprised of individuals from the community. And in the legislation, it describes the different interests. And so assuming that markets are still there in 25 to 50 years, which this is dependent on markets, timber markets, we assume that those benefits from harvest are going to continue. In addition, you've got the buyer itself, which is going to be comprised of timber industry and business perspectives. And so, you know, like our transaction in Washington State, one of the specific pieces of language in their letters of incorporation, I'm sorry, I was lost it for a second, was that these shall be maintained as long-term working forest lands.
Okay. But that would be decided on by each one of them as they set themselves up.
That's correct. And the municipality, who will be the conduit between the underwriters and the actual borrower.
And again, it would be the same issue with regard to those people first appointed. They could go in and decide, well, we could pay this debt off if we log all of the land, and then we'd have this property available. Can they sell the property as any other group could in small chunks after they've issued their debt service and had it done?
They could, I mean, They are private entities, so they could sell it. But once again, our purpose here is...
Okay, keep going.
Yeah, our purpose here is to create organizations that will, if you will, bring together these different interests that protect both the conservation benefits for which they're interested and also the timber harvest or working forest benefits for which they were put together. I mean, any landowner, and in fact, what's going on in other parts of the country now, that's already happening. Mr. Shelk and I were talking at lunch about the state of Florida where not revenue bonds, but they're issuing general obligation bonds. I think it was $1 billion for forest, actually, I'm sorry, not forest, for just preservation, open space purposes. What you have here is a requirement to, you know, to service your debt. We, and we're, as we're open in this, we talked about ways to include legislative language that would address concerns from folks that think that after the debt is serviced, this would be turned into a park. And we're open to that, and at the same time, we're trying to do it in a way that also leaves the flexibility open for the marketplace because, in fact, again, in 25 to 50 years, you never know what the markets are going to be like, and it's a difficult thing to do.
This same board, are they the managing work, the management of the tract as well? So replanting issues, clearing issues, brush issues?
The Forest Authority Board is not. Once again, I'm going to repeat myself. The Forest Authority Board is simply a conduit issuer. They take a look at a transaction. They say, yes, this is going to meet the public purposes for which we were put together. Long-term working forest conservation. Does it meet that? Yes. The underwriters issue the debt. It's all done within a second, literally a simultaneous close. It goes through the issuing authority to the buyer. That buyer, that private entity, is responsible for managing that forest, just like any private buyer would be. So they would be responsible for reforestation, timber harvest planning, environmental compliance, debt service, et cetera.
But essentially, to your question of who's doing the managing, there is a community board that's put together by the issuing authority that then is a balanced group of people. One of the things that appeals to me on this is that currently, in a lot of timberland activities, you have people that can come to the table and effectively torpedo any suggestion that gets put out, particularly on public land, and there's no cost to it for them. And there's very little education either, because if you can stop an activity, then fine, you stop that activity and you go on to the next. However, if you are forced to put together a management plan, and if the benefit of that is you get to retain this piece of ground and manage that piece of ground, and you get some input into it, then you're required of necessity to come to the table and bargain through disagreements as opposed to litigating them. Now, there's a real educational value and benefit to that that I think we in the Northwest have particularly lost because right now you can make the best deal you can make, and if you don't like it, then you can go to the courts and they can veto something. And that's a real disappointing way to make policy.
Thank you. Representative Sumner, you had a question?
A question. Presuming the formation of these lands, these forests, in semi-public ownership, is there a guarantee somewhere that the public will always have access to these lands for hunting, for fishing, for cross-country skiing? Or will they be locked out? Will Oregonians be able to use these lands in recreational forms?
Sort of the flip side of the other question,
exactly.
which is a good one. I don't mean to. These are we're peeling back layers of the onion, and I'm more than happy to meet with members, follow up on these questions. These are private entities, technically private nonprofits, and so they would be private. And so there would be no mandate that they keep these forest lands open. However, for the same reasons I discussed with Representative Roblin's question, when you have a municipality creating the issuing authority and then you have a buyer comprised of the folks that Mr. Shelk spoke about, recreational access, I imagine, would be at the top of their priority list. They have been with the other entities that we've worked with in other states. There is a sort of a middle ownership category called, an instrumentality, which is a publicly appointed but privately run board. I mean, if the Forest Authority wants that to be a condition of the debt, they could make it a condition of the debt. But we don't mandate it, nor do we mandate a lot of things. We're trying to keep this at these decisions at the local level instead of trying to mandate it from above.
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Burley?
Can I follow up on that? Thank you. Just to give you an example, you know, Mr. Shunk had mentioned the Bull Springs Tree Farm. Now, this is just hypothetical, okay? I mean, nobody has approached these folks. There's no deal in the works or anything. But just hypothetically, we're looking at a 31,000-plus acre piece of property here that was owned by Crown Pacific and is now in the hands of the creditors, which is primarily, well, we don't need to go into that. Down here at the very bottom, you can just barely see these red lines. That is the westernmost urban growth boundary of the city of Bend. Okay, and up here, just off the top of this map, is Sisters. So this is the Highway 20 that runs between the two. All the green is federal land, both Forest Service and BLM. Okay, and you can see some of these parcels down here right near the city that have already been sold off. And this is huge mule deer winter range, and elk for that matter. A lot of them go down and cross the highway over to Klein Butte and stuff in severe winters. Now, Crown has always been very gracious over the years. This has been open to the public. You can go up here, and there's trails that go from here to the Forest Service and back and forth for mountain bikes and roads for people to travel up there. You can hunt on these properties. And my guess is, for the most part, many of the general public that use this don't even understand when they're on public lands or on private lands, on public lands, on private lands. And if something like this were to happen in the county of Deschutes, I feel confident in saying that not only would we at this table, but the county commissioners and anybody that would be interested in this would say, if we're going to pursue this, we're going to keep this type of stuff open to the public because the public's been using it for recreation, for hunting, for whatever the case may be. But at the same time, we want to maintain this key winter range habitat for the mule deer, and we can still manage this property to generate the revenues that we need.
Yeah. That being the case, thank you very much. If that being the case, then there's not a big lot of difference here between your plan and a special service district. There's not a lot of difference, is there? Or can you point out any differences?
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, I'm not that familiar with the special district legislation, how they're created, but I do believe special districts, for the most part, at least the park districts that I'm aware of, which are special districts under the ORS, have taxing authorities. This would not have taxing authority.
That's the difference. Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Bowe, please.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And just before I jump, just to re-clarify and make sure I'm right, is you're going to pay property taxes?
Yes.
Right. So that's just not awesome.
Property harvest taxes, whatever the applicable taxes would be, yes.
Yeah. Isn't the bill allow that the municipality that put them into being to give them the right to or not to?
I like the way he's answering his question.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, the bill does give the option to the municipality, and you know, here in Deschutes County, there have been some acquisitions of properties. In fact, the 1,400-acre Metolius Reserve right out here that the Deschutes Basin Land Trust acquired from Weyerhaeuser. It's my understanding, and I may stand corrected, but it's my understanding that Deschutes County agreed to allow them to take it off the tax roll. So some counties do like that flexibility. I know Jefferson County, for example, they don't. I think a lot of it has to do with the property values that you've got in the county. So you do have this opportunity, but we're not trying to get away from any of this stuff. These are all part of who sets them up and what the purpose is and how you want to structure these things.
Follow up. I mean, and for the record, I guess for the President Okachop, I own timber, so I know a little bit something about this. So my line of questioning is, you know, really economic feasibility here, because, you know, what we're talking about is Boise Cascade, which, I mean, I guess for the record, since they don't own any timber here, their new owners are taking different management techniques already, and I've seen it firsthand on property adjoining mine. And you're talking about there's 600,000 acres on the auction block shortly. I mean, with this authority, I mean, what are you going to end up with? Are we trying to get out ahead of this and buy the land before it's creamed and it's not worth anything else, or are we trying to, you know, what is the real economic intent behind here, if you follow what I'm saying? I think Representative Burley maybe is. I mean, a lot of these properties we're talking about that would be available are our properties. They're going to come in and cream, and then you're not really going to have a whole lot left over unless 20, 40, 60 years from now you go back to the timber. That's not going to solve your problem of where do I get timber today? And maybe, and I'm not sure which one of you can answer that, but I think it really comes up to defining, does it work and will it work, and then maybe throw an example out of where it's worked in the state of Washington or something else. Because my biggest concern in this is it's a daylight dollar short by the time we get it done.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, first of all, let me start by saying this: the reason that I agreed to introduce this bill, this is not a panacea for the forest products industry. I mean, if we don't solve the issues on our federal lands, that's, to me, this is like Humpty Dumpty sitting on the wall. If we start losing these parcels, these large blocks of industrial land, if they start getting piecemealed off, we'll never get them back together again. So that's my concern. And we've seen this happen. There's a 37,000 acre block out here just north of town that was recently bought by a private investor, and they turned around and applied for a destination resort overlay on it. It used to be good commercial forest land. We saw formerly Boise Cascade lands north of McCall in Idaho have already been offered for sale for ski resort developments and other types of developments. The former Kinzua lands out in the John Day Basin, same type of thing. So we're already starting to see this happen. And that's, you know, the economics aside, I mean, this is why I'm interested in this. Now, the due diligence process on this would be just like any other person. If Hampton Affiliates or SPI or Malheur Lumber or any other company wanted to come in here and look at buying, whether it's these lands or Boise's or whatever, or a private nonprofit that we would put together in Deschutes County, you would go through the exact same due diligence process that you would in any other type of private transaction.
This is just one further tool in the tool bag to retain timberland. And one of the things that we're talking about here is a land use issue also. As these large parcels get broken up into 160 acres and smaller, particularly over here on the dry side, as I say, people put horses on them, and they put llamas, and they put all sorts of livestock on them, and the intense grazing that takes place on that small enclosed parcel is you see some of the worst land use in the world in these small llama farms. It's from the standpoint of water pollution, from the standpoint of runoff and erosion. It's absolutely terrible what goes on those parcels. So you've got a real developing problem in land use issues. Not to mention when you go 150 yards and there's a fence, and another 150 yards and another fence, then wildlife don't have their reasonable corridors to move through, and you get some real there's some real severe wildlife issues. And this isn't just an Eastern Oregon issue. This same issue is developing in southwestern Oregon as well. So this isn't just an east of the Cascades issue. It's one that we're seeing right now, but we're seeing and we're seeing it severely now, but it's beginning to replicate itself west of the Cascades also.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have to move on because we have other people who want to testify on this, and I want to have a full public hearing on this. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to call Mike Hayward, Delaware County. Because you drove more than 100 miles. I think I did, too.
About 350.
Whoa. Well, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Hayward. I'm chairman of the Wallowa County Board of Commissioners. I appreciate the opportunity to give some brief remarks about this bill and issue my support for it. Everything that was said a few moments ago, I would echo, and you guys don't have time to have me echo those verbatim, so I won't do that.
Thank you very much.
I would just like to add a couple of thoughts. I believe the problem is very real, and I don't believe that land use planning can fix this problem. We thought at one time that if you didn't let people divide property smaller than 160 acres, nobody would buy it except for resource use. That's not true anymore. Especially in Wallowa County, that's a small problem for people with enough money. So we have to look for other ways to keep industrial timberland in industrial production. And I think this gives us one more tool to do that. And as was stated earlier, it is not a fix-all for all the problems, but it is one more tool. Wallowa County, it was mentioned, well, Wallowa County wasn't mentioned, but the old Boise Cascade lands were mentioned. We have 160,000 acres of Boise lands in Wallowa County, approximately. We don't know what's going to happen with those lands, but the way a county commissioner judges if you have a problem that you need to work on is what your community folks are saying. And I literally cannot go to a restaurant in Enterprise or a ball game in Joseph without somebody coming up to me and saying, what are you doing about this? What's your involvement? How are you going to make sure that that land stays working for us, stays accessible, so that we can use it to hunt and fish, to cross-country ski, and all those things that they've done for years? And so that's why I'm supportive of this, and our Board of Commissioners is, and we are interested in pursuing this and seeing what we can do to keep those forests working. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Boquist?
Of course I'm going to follow up here.
Of course.
Mike, and I saw that Representative Burley was whispering back to you. Do you have any examples that have worked? Do we know of any examples that have worked in the state of Washington? And by the way, you know, I'm talking about the Boise Cascade and Wallowa. You know what they're doing. They're clear-cutting. They're going in and doing things that we didn't traditionally do now, and that's why people are coming to you and beating your door down in the restaurants. So do we know some places this has actually worked?
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist, I do not know. I am not familiar with what's happened in Washington State. I am aware, I'm very aware of the challenges that we see in the current management of the Boise, or part of the Boise lands, at least, in Wallowa County, and the need to turn that corner. One of the things that was asked earlier is, can we expect a forest authority to have to do the same thing, or would there be anything left when a forest authority bought the land? I think it has to be structured so that you may not have a lot of timber harvest for a number of years. And on this side of the state, we're talking about maybe up to 80 to 100 years. So the financing package would have to be structured to take that into consideration. And the reality is, we might be there to pick up the pieces after another company overcuts.
Thank you. Thank,
thank
you very much, and thank you for making the trip. David Mormon, Oregon Department of Forestry.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is David Mormon. I'm the director of the Forest Resources Planning Program at the Oregon Department of Forestry, and I'm here to testify in support of the concepts in House Bill 2729. This is a bill that we were neutral on in the 2003 session, but we did quite a bit of study on the same issue and came up with a lot of the same conclusions that you've heard from the proponents of the bill, and are very encouraged by this bill being introduced in this session and do want to register our support for it. As the previous speakers have talked about, the federal harvest reductions, the loss of manufacturing infrastructure, and disinvesting of forest lands by forest products corporations is all resulting in concerns about what's going to happen to the future of our working forests in eastern Oregon and other parts of the state. And we feel like this is a potential tool that can address those concerns and deserves your consideration. This bill is very consistent with some of the long-term goals that the Oregon Board of Forestry has established. And two of those goals, which I think are relevant here, are to maintain and enhance the productive capacity of Oregon's forests to improve the economic well-being of Oregon communities, and also to ensure that Oregon's forests continue to provide a diverse social and economic outputs valued by the public in a fair, balanced, and efficient manner. We believe this is a tool that can help in that regard. In our testimony, we've highlighted some issues that the committee may want to consider as it works on this bill, and I guess I would just close to say, again, we support the bill, and we'd be glad to work with the committee and with the proponents to make it a tool that will work for Oregon.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Mormon? None. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for coming here. Miles Conway. Is he here? Kelly Smith. Oh, Miles is here. Okay, I'm sorry. No, that's okay. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Miles Conway. I'm with the Schwabe Williamson & Wyatt Law Firm. We don't have any position on the bill. I just wanted to ask a few questions. Looking at it, there's a few things about the legislation I didn't understand. First, as someone who represents a number of private forestry landowners, is it clear that there's no condemnation authority attached to this bill? This entity wouldn't have the ability to condemn private lands?
That's my understanding, correct.
The thing I don't understand the most is the difference. The buyer itself is made up of a private nonprofit. Is there a public role in the private nonprofit, or does that simply act like a corporation? How does the public get their interests and their input into the management decisions and the long-term management of that land once it gets into the private nonprofit? Can people go to meetings, or is it like a corporate board that you can't participate in?
Madam Chair, maybe we should change positions here.
It's fine. Representative Burley, could you answer?
The bill says that the board of the private nonprofit has to be made up of so many members that come from the business sector, so many that come from the conservation community sector, and so many public at large seats. So you've got that spectrum of representation on the board. And you know, again, presumably you would the business interest would at least have good expertise in forest management, resource management type stuff.
Okay, so the representation on the board basically there's no public meetings or public notice or anything. It's a question of getting good representation on the board. Then is that the
That one I couldn't answer specifically. I don't believe it would be subject to the state public meeting laws because it is not a public entity.
It doesn't sound like it to me, and I guess that was my concern, was you get this board which seems to have a good makeup, but then they'd have an awful lot of discretion to do, potentially take positions that are contrary to, I think, what everyone's goals are with the legislation. That was one of the biggest concerns that I had.
Interesting point. Thank you. Is there anything else?
Just one or two
okay.
more. I had a couple questions about the Bull Springs block, and because I represent some clients with some lands near there, and so I have some familiarity with that, and I think that's a good example of some of these issues. It's a piece of ground that was owned by Crown Pacific for some time, and it's been harvested pretty severely. And it's going to be some time before I think it can be economically viably harvested again. So my question is whether if this group buys that, how do they value that? I mean, it sits between the urban growth boundary of Bend and Sisters. Is it purchased on a fair market value based on timberlands or based on development potential? And how do you know that the revenues, if timber isn't supporting itself now in the state of Oregon, how are the revenues associated with this going to pay for the debt if it's bought by this entity? I mean, it's kind of halfway between a private market thing and a public thing, and I don't understand how it could work.
The way I understood it was it would work willing seller, willing buyer, determined the price. It's a private enterprise.
You go through the same due diligence process you would anywhere else. If you can't make a pencil out, it's not going to happen. And you're right, in the case of Crown Pacific's properties, when they were facing bankruptcy 4 or 5 years ago, they aggressively tried to market it, and they had a hard time selling it. You're right. But again, the Bull Springs, like I said, I mean, that was just an example to point out how something like this would be applicable. I'm not saying that's currently in the process or anything like that.
Would this entity have the ability to sell land? And then I'll sit down. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think we answered that earlier. That is not by this bill, not precluded, but it could be through the Articles of Incorporation. Other types of things could limit or prohibit those types of dispositions.
Okay. Well, I'll just close by saying I think the Articles of Organization or whatever corporate documents went on would be a very important document, and something I think the public would want to have some role in. That's all I have. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk.
It's been very interesting. Thank you. And you can submit written testimony if you read further into that and you'd like to give us any, you know. Yeah, thank you very much. I have Kelly Smith signed up. Thank you.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Smith. I live here in Bend. In fact, I live adjacent to this Bull Springs parcel that you've been hearing about. And I would like to emphasize a couple of things that and support the bill, a couple of things that you've heard already. There is a huge problem with conversion of timberlands to what is turning out to be residential properties. I'm most familiar with the area around Bend and Sisters, but I think it's true certainly statewide and in other states as well. And you've heard how there are detrimental effects to wildlife habitat, to recreation, to timber production, of course, and to fire danger as well. And in addition to the fire danger that you've heard about, we had a presentation earlier today about the effects of drought and the weather problems we're having now. And the more of these properties that get put into residential ownership, I think the more problems with the water table we're going to have, especially on the dry side over here. We have water supply problems already, and if we're going to be having more and more of these 160-acre parcels with homes on them, we're going to have more water problems. In regards to the Bull Springs parcel itself, it's about a 35,000-acre parcel, or was, and already 10% of that has been sold off. This was just a few years ago part of a land swap with the Forest Service with the intent of blocking up the land so that they could be better managed for timber, both on the Forest Service part and on the private ownership, the Crown Pacific part. Well, now the lands are getting sold off and split off, and of course what's happening is it's being sold off the closest parts to Bend and the closest parts that are most valuable for development. But it's going to keep on going, and I think that other than for developers and perhaps a few fairly wealthy people that can afford to buy these, it's detrimental to all involved. One more comment on the fire danger issue. As part of the efforts to control fire danger or to alleviate the danger when these lands are developed, a lot of the lands are cleared of brush and thinned in the small timber and so forth, which is also detrimental to wildlife habitat. The area, this particular area, is in the Tumalo Deer Winter Range. It's not just a general sort of winter range area, but it's a state designated winter range where the population of deer is already, I think, 30 to 40% below the management objectives. So any of these things that decrease that value of the habitat are also hurting that deer winter range. I want to emphasize another point that was just made about the problem that land use planning won't solve this problem. We've been involved in testifying on to the county commission on several properties, and the counties are basically hamstrung with what they can do, and probably rightly so. I mean, they can't say no to a lot of these things because the law says you can do this. You can split up the land. So what's good about this bill is that it doesn't say you have to do it this way, but it allows local communities and local private landowners to go this route. And I think it's a valuable tool. It's not going to be an answer in all problems. There are going to be some properties that it won't make sense for, but it's a possibility. And if it solves 10% of the problem, then, boy, that's 10% of the problem that we didn't have solved before. So I guess that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't have anyone else signed up. Is there anyone else who wanted to? And I need you to state your name. And
yes, my name is Mark Rubert, Chair Smith, members of the committee. I haven't been aware of this bill before, but I have been involved in several of the properties out here. My wife and I own over 9,000 acres in eastern Crook County. And so we've been studying some of the issues you guys have talked about. It's a real conundrum. The problem I see with this proposal is the economics. If a private private industry cannot make the land work for forestry use, there's no way a public ownership with public committee management can be nearly as efficient as a private landowner that can make hard decisions without having to placate a committee. I've also got a degree in forest engineering and includes a lot of forest economics. I just wouldn't see how that could possibly work economically. As far as the private ownerships go, right now that land is zoned for a minimum of 240 acres. There's some caveats as far as private development goes and what you can do to it as far as leaving it in forest and whatnot. That can be both a good and a bad thing, and it will shut down public access. If it's broken up into smaller private ownerships, no one's going to want the general public with a bike trail through their yard. It's just not going to happen. It's going to be fenced and made off limits. At the same time, there are benefits. For example, fire. A small property owner will have, if he can afford the property, he'll have more money and much more incentive to actively reduce fire danger. Right now, like I said, we've been looking into some of these properties. If you build on them, you're required to mow the property, to thin the trees, raise a few ladders, and they will actually benefit greatly from moving to a smaller ownership over an industrial forest land or your plan, because the money is not there to spend $200 to $400 an acre to manage a fuel load. It's just not going to be there. It's totally uneconomical. If you gave me the property for free and I had to put $400 an acre in and wait 80 years for a harvest, it wouldn't happen. Another thing was mentioned was game feed. There is a lot of brush out there. It's mature brush. The deer can't utilize it. It's thick, it's woody, it's overgrown. It's just like a pasture. To get good feed, you have to knock it back periodically. Historically, this was a fire-based regime where fire came through periodically, knocked all the brush back, trimmed out the lower limbs on the trees, got rid of the reprod. You had the big mature trees and a succulent understory that was rejuvenated from time to time. If you went to the smaller ownerships, it would benefit from that. By the same token, it would be nice to maintain the recreation here. I'm not for that per se. I'm just pointing out facts for you all to consider. The one idea that came to me as I was sitting there listening to all this was some kind of public easement purchased from the major industrial forest owners, where they would retain the right to own the forest and use it for commercial forestry purposes. But at the same token, if there was some method to fund a purchase of rights to ensure public access and to purchase the development rights, something like the Nature Conservancy does, where they'll purchase a property, put it into a permanent moratorium on development, and sell it back to a private landowner who then has that with the title so it can never be developed. But some scheme like that would seem to me, with the addition of guaranteed public access, private ownership of the timber, to be a better deal than what's being proposed. Thank you.
Any questions? I'm seeing none. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
And I'm glad you used the word scheme and not me. Thank you very much. I want to close the public hearing on House Bill 2729, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2729. Representative Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2729 be...
It has a referral to the revenue.
Be recommended out with a due pass to Revenue Committee.
I have a motion from Representative Boquist to move House Bill 2729 to the Revenue with a due pass. Do you have any discussion? Representative Hass?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Representative Burley for bringing this forward. I was on the Revenue Committee last session when we took this up, Mr. Tuckman, and it was a little bit tough to grasp at that point in the session, and I'm glad we're still talking about this, because I do agree that there is a conundrum here, and I think there are some amendments, particularly with public records and some of those that we could, and that's part of this process to keep fleshing this out, and I think we can get there, so I'm very supportive.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Representative Beyer?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions about this bill, too, but I'd be very happy to send them the bill to the Revenue Committee and let them try to answer some of them.
You. Representative Boquist?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Let me, I guess, speak to my motions.
Yes.
And Chuck, start taking notes.
Aren't you on the Revenue Committee?
I'm on the Revenue Committee. Representative Burley is going to be sending a bunch of amendments down here to the Revenue Committee. Just very quickly, ma'am, a couple of things. I do know that the economics work out because I've been involved in the Crown Pacific, and it's financing that becomes the key issue on this, and so I do this. One point I need to point out, because I'm involved in nonprofit boards, is nonprofits have a broader spectrum of public disclosure than corporations do, and so I'm familiar with that. I think many of the issues, the key issues that have here, have to do with city-county revenue-type issues and taxation issues and things like that, and it's not so much the working details. And in light of the fact that we have to get up and move faster in the House of Representatives before we get this across to the Senate, I made the motion, and I think I'd be happy to work with Representative Burley to flesh out these details so that by the time that it comes up in our committee with Representative Hassan and Revenue, that we have some of the answers to this, because I think it will provide a tool. I'm not convinced it will, how fast we can move on this, but it is another tool in the toolbox, and given the fact that in Wallowa County, I've already seen the early stages of what happened, what Crown Pacific Lands went through, I think speed is the essence here to make something like this work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Rubin.
I'll just make a quick comment. I too, am looking forward to getting this bill moved on to Revenue. And for me, the issue is having working forests. In Coos County, we have a mill that's just starting up. And the biggest issue with getting that mill to happen was a product, having the materials necessary to keep the mill going. And they had to make a long protracted agreements with a number of private owners, as well as hoping that the state and federal lands will produce another percentage. And to make it work out for them, the availability of forest product was essential. And if this does lead to that, so we have working forests for the long term in Oregon, then I think we're moving in the right direction, and we're also serving both the public and the private interests that we need to keep this economy going.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to add, we heard some very good comments today and questions and concerns with this bill, and I think Representative Burley took some very good notes. And in the legislative process, you do have to move things along, so I thank you, committee, for helping me move this to Revenue so that we can have further discussions on this bill. And with that, all clerk will call the roll.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Representative Hatch?
Yes.
Representative Logan?
Yes.
Representative
Sumner?
Aye.
And Chair Smith? Votes aye. The chair votes aye. We've passed bill, House Bill 2729, to the Revenue Committee. And that will close the work session on House Bill 2729, and we'll open a public hearing on 2929. And Patrick, do you want to fill us in?
Yes, Madam Chair. House Bill 2929 was one of the five measures we introduced as a committee measure back in February, I believe it was. The bill allows the transfer of landowner preference tags for hunting deer or elk to any person of the landowner's choosing. I believe Paul Rainey has a panel here.
We have several people. We have quite a few people signed up. I think we have a panel. Oh, okay. Why don't you tell us who you have with it? Well, when you get set up, they will. I've been promoted.
Senator Smith.
Yeah.
No longer the majority.
That's okay. I get called Senator Smith a lot. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Paul Rainey. With me is Steve Mathers, the president of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association, and Mike Crawford, who is with Battle Creek Outfitters, located here in Bend. On behalf of the small businesses of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association, we appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon about the LOP program. We especially appreciate the help Representative Burley has provided in helping bring this issue forward. As you are aware, the LOP tag program is a valuable tool that helps landowners control damage on their property caused by deer and elk. In 1995, legislation was passed to allow approximately one-third of antlered LOP tags to be transferred. In addition, all antlerless tags may be transferred today. This change was made primarily to give landowners more flexibility to control animal damage that's hosted on their property. In 2001, this concept was once again supported as the sunset was extended to 2010. The legislation before you today is also scheduled to sunset in 2010 to assure that the program is carefully considered and unintended consequences don't result. The reason we're here today is we believe we can strengthen an existing program. Our goal as sponsors of House Bill 2929 is to realize the multiple benefits within the current program for landowners, outfitters, and hunters. In 1995 and again in 2001, legislators, commissioners, and landowners, as well as sport leaders, set the precedent for expanding the program to allow tags to be transferred. What we are asking for today does not change this concept. It simply gives more access to LOP tags to the public and more flexibility to landowners. Today, outfitters in Oregon are faced with the challenge of a competitive allocation process that keeps valuable tags in short supply. In 1997, the legislator created the Guides and Outfitter Program, giving outfitters the ability to market non-resident tags. And in addition to being designed to bring stability to the hunting season for outfitters, this program also is a significant revenue source for ODF&W. Unfortunately, the allocation process is very competitive, as several regions are more popular for hunts. As a result, many outfitters lose out in their own backyard as they're unable to draw the tag that they need for their business. For many small outfitters, this has a devastating impact on their business. We believe that a reasonable solution is by simply enhancing the existing program that works well today. The Landowner Preference Tag Program currently manages for the potential issuance of 15,935 tags for each deer and elk controlled hunt series. These tags are issued with the expectations of being filled. The question we really face is, who should get to harvest the wildlife? Our answer is simple. Everyone should have the ability to participate in the program and have access to these tags. That is why we're here today, is to realize the benefits embodied within the legislation, and we believe that House Bill 2929 will give landowners who don't hunt the ability to ease damage to their property. It will increase hunting opportunities for small outfitter businesses in Oregon, and it gives the public the same access to these landowner preference tags. Today, many landowners have the ability to get one landowner preference tag. However, if they are not interested in hunting, they don't have the same options to ease damage to their property as a landowner who's interested in hunting. Allowing the tags to be transferred gives them the same right by letting a friend, a guide, fill the tag for them. If the goal of the LOP tag program is to provide a form of non-monetary compensation for providing wildlife habitat and to assist landowners with addressing wildlife, let's give all landowners this ability, not just landowners who hunt. For the guides and outfitters, we continue to face fiscally challenging times, and these small businesses play a vital role in strengthening Oregon's rural economic outlook. An LOP tag provides certainty for these small businesses that allow them to go and market it. These hunts are often high-value hunts with multipliers that ripple through local communities. Allowing LOP tags to be transferred gives outfitters additional opportunities to secure a hunt in their region, especially in areas where the outfitter tag allocation is extremely competitive. And finally, the access to public hunters. The existing LOP tag program already gives guides and outfitters, as well as the public, a limited chance to gain additional hunting opportunities through this program. What we're asking today is to ensure that everyone has access to this program by allowing all tags to be transferred. It is our belief that the more tags available to the public will help reduce the competitiveness within the resident tag allocation process. Finally, increased landowner ability to ease the damage for hosting wildlife on their private property will push deer and elk back onto public land. So essentially what we're proposing is to improve the present LOP program and give everyone access. With good management of the program by ODF&W and flexibility, it will give landowners, outfitters, numerous benefits within the existing program. On behalf of the Guides and Packers Association, we ask that you support House Bill 2929 and appreciate your time and consideration. With that, I'll turn it over to Steve Matthews.
Representative Chair Smith, thank you for the opportunity. I believe this bill is a benefit to the hunters, the landowners, and outfitters. I, as an outfitter, have to work up a personal relationship between landowners to get be able to lease their land. I have to go to them, talk to them, and build their trust. And the general public, the hunters, can do the same thing that I do. I mean, they can, and this can happen. Landowners are not just going to let someone who they don't know on their property. They're going to have to build a relationship with them, and this gives the opportunity for the hunter, the landowner, anybody to give the opportunity to build this relationship up and get these tags. This bill gives landowners opportunity to mitigate their damage, open their land up so that they can improve their land so that the habitat will increase the number on there. They can sell these tags or give them to friends. There's a benefit to the landowner that be less damage hunts. Right now, going to be less emergency hunts, less damage hunts, so there's more opportunity to increase animal numbers in Oregon. And by increasing the populations of deer or elk, these animals aren't going to stay on private land all the time. They're going to be on public land. So this is actually a benefit to everybody by increasing the animal numbers. This bill doesn't increase the number of landowner tags. It just makes all of them transferable. ODF&W has some questions on some issues. The outfitter tag program, for example, in the Beulah unit, we applied for five tags and only received one of those in the East Beulah. Yet in the West Beulah, where there's lots of public land, we got all of those. So in the private land is basically where the problem is in the outfitter program, where there's not the opportunity to get the enough tags. Also, ODF&W mentioned the point that by increasing the animals on some private land units, that there'll be damage going across to other, you know, smaller landowners nearby. Well, I think that could be addressed by adding a fee to the landowner tags, so that they could do some permanent, damage control, building fences on these other properties, so that these animals don't damage it. Right now, Access and Habitat has some temporary solutions where they hire hazers to come on, chase the elk off. I mean, these are temporary. In one unit, they actually give the landowner a night vision scope so that they can go shoot elk at night in the fields. I mean, these are all temporary solutions. So this is the things that I think this bill will address.
Thank you. My name is Mike Crawford. Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. Being last kind of hurts here a little bit. A couple of things that I came up with is in Oregon, as has been talked all day so far, our ranches are getting smaller and smaller, or they're getting bigger. And then when they, the families are getting smaller, as they cannot support two and three generations on our current ranching system in Oregon. So the kids move to town, get jobs, go to college, then their kids. And there's a lot of ranches out there that are not using their LOBs because the grandkids and kids don't hunt. So, like Steve was mentioning, the balance on private land and national forest lands or BLM lands, the wildlife know they can go here and not be harassed. And so then the public complains there's no wildlife on the national forest. It's all on private land. Well, there's nobody over there to kind of ease them back in. Also, in eastern Oregon and central and eastern Oregon, all the valleys got homesteaded. So all your major winter range in Oregon, eastern Oregon, excuse me, is on private land now. So on a hard winter, where's the wildlife going to go? They're going to the valleys. ODFW has no monies to pay the ranchers or the landowners to offset the loss in hay and damage to fences. So what they do, they haze them in the winter, shoot them, give out extra tags to get them off the private land where they're doing the most damage. Also, another thing ODFW's concern is that the outfitter tag permits are not being utilized to its fullest. In order to be an outfitter in Oregon and to get a permit, you have to have a lease. Whether it's a BLM, National Forest, or private land, you have to have a piece of property. You can show the State Marine Board that they can show ODFW that you have the right to be an outfitter on that land. Private land is very hard to come by, as Steve pointed out. You've got to make relationships. The BLM refuses in some units to give you a tag, and in other units, you can get a permit for BLM land. National Forest, you can get a permit on some areas. They limit it really slow, low numbers of outfitters, but you can't camp on their ground. Even though we'll leave the campground cleaner than Joe Public, you can't camp on the ground. So then you got to go to the BLM to get a permit for camping, and if they don't give it to you, then you got to find a rancher that will allow you to camp. So they're concerned about some areas of the tags not being utilized. It's probably because we can't get permits or wildlife numbers are low. I think that's just what I... Oh, fire. A lot of the ranches that we have in eastern Oregon have to pay a dollar an acre for fire protection to the state of Oregon, whether they have a fire or not on their property. This would be one way for the landowners to help recuperate some of that loss in paying that fire fee every year. They could sell to anybody, it doesn't have to be a landowner, anybody, a tag, or two tags or three tags that they can't now to pay for that fire fee protection that they're paying the state. So I think that's all I have. I appreciate you letting me speak.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Anything you want to add,
No, that's it. We just appreciate to be the opportunity to get this discussion.
I guess I do have a couple questions just to make sure that we all understand what this bill is doing. And this may be more of a comment or not, but I mean, they're free to respond. The landowner preference tag as it exists right now in statute sunsets on January 2, 2010, and this bill does not propose to change that whatsoever.
No, it doesn't.
Would you please address, just so that everybody's, we've got all the facts on the table here, what are we doing about the antlerless versus antlered hunts? How does this bill affect that?
Well, it would actually, it would eliminate the antlerless hunts and make it, they all, they could be antlered or antlerless, I believe, is what it would, I think what it would do. And give an example of what now, a rancher with 39,000 acres, with what now he gets one third, he would actually have, he had two tags that he could transfer. If and this one, and we, this bill went through for 39, I think you'd be able to transfer, I think, six now, I think. I think that's what it is. But so the what you can transfer right now is a very minimal number. It's two tags out for up to 39,000. It's not a lot of tags.
I do have one more comment. On the number of tags issued, ODFW has already in place how many tags can be issued. 5,000 acres, 5,000 tags. Then it goes to 30,000 acres, and you only get 7 tags. Up to 60,000 acres, you can get 11 tags. And above that, you get no more tags. Now, Boise sold. We all heard that. There's 300,000 acres in eastern Oregon that sold. We don't know what these people's plans are for that. And everybody has great concerns about what's going to happen to all that land. This does not allow Boise to just go in there and give 100 tags out. They're only got 11 tags for 300,000 acres. It's not going to add a whole lot more hunting where ODFW is trying to balance things out. It's not a giveaway to anybody. There's checks and balances in the system already. We're just asking that the rancher, and I know ranchers that husband and wife are in the 60s, there's nobody else there. They've got five tags, and they're getting some damage, and they have no way to recoup their losses for that, and they're paying the fire fee. This would help them a little bit. It's not a great fix, but it's a little bit that we can do without costing anybody extra money.
I have a couple things I can add. We've been to OHA and discussed that with them. You know, we've opened with ODFW and OHA and made some discussions asking for comments from them, and so far we've gotten none. So they've not commented back to us on any recommendations on our bill.
And I assume you mean by OHA, Oregon Hunters Association.
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The state of Oregon is the only entity that can sell a tag.
Correct.
Okay, so you or the landowners or whoever has these tags, you cannot sell this tag.
No. We're
what
selling.
What is saleable right. is the access to the private
it.
Land.
Correct.
To get it, yeah.
Now, I'd like your comments and your thoughts on if we move in the direction that your bill's taking us, and I'm very sensitive to this because when my kids were young and we were trying to find places to go hunt, especially up on game birds, we saw more and more of these private lands being leased out, and we were, you know, just losing opportunities, places to go find places to hunt. I'd like your thoughts on how, if at all, this bill might affect right now the general hunting population's ability to access private lands.
Well, most of the private lands now are, you know, the landowner has them closed up, you know, and only allowing friends on there. So this would actually allow, if you wanted to make an effort to make a, you know, a friends with a landowner, he would have the opportunity to give you those tags, to transfer more of those tags. I mean, the ranchers are just not letting people go out and, you know, opening their lands up to hunters very much. I mean, they're most lands are closed, and this wouldn't change that, but it would actually, but it would make it more, they would have more opportunity to get landowner tags, so they could give their friends or could give people who work help come out and help with them. You know, I think the opportunity is there for both, for me to work, make a deal with ranchers and other, and the general public too also.
If I could address that question as well, one of the goals with this was to open up access so that the more tags were available. And as Steve mentioned, a lot of it is through friends. But it does give the public, if they've built those relationships, an additional chance to go and get those tags. And one of the reasons that we have this kept the sunset in 2010 is we recognize that change is difficult. And we want to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences that come with that. So that's why we want to revisit this to make sure there aren't any concerns that would come from the public hunting opportunities being lost.
Representative Roblin.
Quick question, just this brought
sure.
up. Oregon has taken the liability away from hunters that go on private land. We have a law that allows that to happen. Does that change when they lease their property out?
Yes, I believe it does. Then we have to supply liability insurance on all properties we do, so I believe it does.
So, and once they lease it out to an outfitter, that even if they opened it up to a friend, would the liabilities go with that? Or was it per issue, do you know?
I can answer that. Our insurance policy is a $2 million policy. Outfitters also are down to just two insurance companies in the U.S. that will insure us. But anyway, we carry $2 million. The rancher is listed as an also insured. So anybody that he allows in there would, yes, fall under our deal.
Representative Sumner, did you have a question?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think we have some others here. Bill McCormick. And I have about four or five other people signed up to testify, so we'll try to get through these. Thank you. Hello.
That's okay. Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Bill McCormick. I reside at 288
77 Southeast Bear Creek Road in Prineville, Oregon. I'm part of a partner in McCormick & Sons. It's a family-owned cattle ranch in on the southern edge of the Maury Mountains in Cook County. We have about 30,000 acres deeded, run cattle, deer, elk, that are all on the property. I look at this issue as kind of a compensation for damage that we incur year to year. We have about 500 acres of alfalfa irrigated type acreage. We lose in the end of the summer a third of our second cutting to primarily elk, some deer, bedding in the fields, eating it. They run through the fences, which repair 5 to 7 miles of fence just from elk damage every year. It's not easy out there. We look at the wildlife as another entity. On the ranch, we have to plan for where they're going to be and where our cattle are going to be and make sure there's enough forage for our cattle. So with this bill being able to transfer those tags to anyone we choose, it would make it easier to recoup some of the losses. We cannot sell the tag. I want that very clear. We can only sell access or give access. The tag is still, if somebody from out of state wants one of the tags, they have to pay an out of state fee for the tag, or in state if they're if they reside in Oregon. Elk numbers in our area are due to increase because Fish and Wildlife isn't going to increase the MO's management objective. That is a reason I believe this program needs to change a little bit. We're going to have more damage, not right away, but eventually. I do this every day. So, I have friends that I'll say it again that are landowners. They don't have any relatives. Don't have any way to transfer the tags. They'd like to say thanks to some people that come out and build fence, do habitat projects, but they can't transfer a bull tag. They can switch those tags and then do cow tags, but it's more exciting to find horns every once in a while. It makes more of a hunt of it, I guess. With that, I've submitted written statement. With that, I appreciate being able to speak, and if there's any questions.
Thank you. Any questions,
be happy.
Mr. McCormick? You did just fine.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming here. I'm going to call Bryce. Is it Lujan? Logan. I'm sorry. You're over 100 miles.
Chairman Smith, members of the committee. My name's Bryce Logan. I'm a rancher and outfitter in Wheeler County. I became an outfitter because of elk damage, basically. We had a choice on our ranch whether to try to eliminate the elk that were eating all our forage or to incorporate them into our whole management plan. It seemed, since I like to hunt as well as other people in my family and our business like to hunt, we like wildlife, we like just to look at them, it made much more sense to find a way to make them complementary to our livestock operation. So we started outfitting. The biggest hindrance to being able to run an outfitting operation is access to tags. We have access to the land. I also lease some hunting land. We lease. I own a small portion of the land that we're on. My family owns a bigger part, and then I lease some adjoining land, both for grazing and hunting. Like I said, the biggest hindrance to being able to run a business, and I'm trying to raise five kids on a ranch. The livestock don't do it without the wildlife. We need access to more tags. The first step with the outfitter tags was a big help, but there's a limited number of tags, and it's not the whole answer. When they changed the LOP program to where you could transfer part of the tags, that was also a help, but it's, again, not the whole answer. We use our LOP tags. We use them for family. We use them for friends who help us. We use them for people who just are able to talk me into letting them come and hunt sometimes. And I don't understand any rationale to limit them only to family members. In my mind, it ought to be up to the landowner to decide how much damage they have, whether they're in a position where they need to sell tags or they get more benefit by giving them to their friends, other people in their family, or people who help them out some way. That ought to be a landowner's decision. There's not enough family members always to use up the tags that we get. There are always friends, relatives, and hunters who want the tags. As it is now, we have years when we don't use all the LOP tags because of the ones that are not transferable. The ones that are transferable get used up. The other point I think that's important here is that by making more tags transferable, it does not, at least in our part of the world, it won't change one bit how much public access that there is to our ranch. Ranches in general, and in our area in particular, and I think statewide, at least on the east side, they're not going to be thrown open to strangers and just the general public to come and hunt. There will always be controlled by the landowner. So whether the landowner has more tags that they can transfer or less isn't going to change how much access there is to the general public. It will make more tags available to members of the public who are not family members, and also solves a problem that I used to have, which is that my father-in-law had landowner tags for family members that he couldn't transfer to me because I'm an in-law and not blood relative. Even though I'm there managing the ranch and doing all the work, there were times when I couldn't get tags. And I'm not sure that that's a legitimate way to do business by the state. With that, if there's any questions.
Representative Beyer?
Yeah, as I've been listening to this, thank you, Madam Chair. You said that you yourself are a guide or packer, right?
Yes.
And as I listen to this, I wonder how many more people would become guides and packers, you know, and handle their own properties as opposed to allowing other people onto their properties. Do you have any comment on that?
I don't think that it will change. The people who are inclined to try to operate a hunting business are already doing it. They already have access to some tags, and if they were inclined to be selling access to make use of those tags, most likely they would do it. And the change in getting one or two more tags is not going to change how they look at life, I don't believe.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Logan, very much.
Thank you.
Carl L. Elkins and Kelly Smith.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I know that time is short, Madam Chair, so I will try to keep my comments brief. Before you, I have two pages of testimony. With me today is Kelly Smith, the former chairman and president of OHA, and he's going to answer some of the questions in regards to access that have come up today. What I've attempted to do here is lay out what programs exist. In my testimony, I've what programs already exist. On the first page, I talk about antlered and deer and elk, and the data provided by ODFW in 2003 of over 17 million acres were registered for deer, buck deer and elk on 7,477 properties. That's the total number of tags that they have issued. Paul was right. This program was set up to provide landowners for a non-monetary compensation for providing habitat for wildlife and for wildlife damage on property. The program was revisited in 91, and the legislature adopted some of their recommendations in 93, and it changed and liberalized the program even more, from what people tell me. As you know, and as I have testified before your committee in the past, we are an 11,000-member conservation-based organization. And last year alone, we put over $250,000 of our members' money directly in the ground for wildlife and habitat restoration projects. We believe that the wildlife in the state of Oregon belongs to the public. And we have already in place compensation for landowners, non-monetary compensation. But we also have in place a program for Oregon's guides and packers to also use that wildlife that belongs to the public. And if my memory serves me correct, in 97, the guides and outfitters supported HB 3387. They may have sponsored it. I can't recall back that far, but we were in support of it too. And through the program administered by ODFW, they have access to one half of the non-resident tags drawn in the previous year. Now, I know Mr. Mathers has testified to that. Unfortunately, when he was talking, somebody went by with their cell phone going off, and I couldn't hear all that he said. So I don't know what his point was in that. However, it is interesting to note that less than 15% of the non-resident tags allocated to them are issued each year. Data compiled by ODFW shows that from 1998 through 2004, between 1,500 and 26 tags were available to the guides and outfitters. Less than 500 tags have been issued each year. That means between 1,200 and 2,000 tags that were available. My point in bringing all this up is, if this is a discussion about tags, is this a discussion about tags for landowners, for guides and packers? It was my understanding when this first started, when I first read the bill, it had to do with landowners. But now I think it has to do more or less with the availability for tags for guides and packers. And if that's the issue, then we need to look at that system and see what we can do in relation to, if it's all possible, making more tags available for them. They're not using what they're allocated now. I don't know the reasons why. I'm sure Mr. Mather said that when the cell phone was going off, but I certainly don't know the answer. So my question is, what's the real issue here? And we've got two state-mandated, state-controlled programs that seem to be working and working well. A lot of tags are going out, just not a lot of tags are being used. The last point I want to make, and then Mr. Kelly can talk about Mr. Smith can talk about the access summary. Answer some of the questions related to access. We have a program administered through ODFW called Oregon's Access and Habitat Program. Mr. Smith was a state-level member of that group and local member for a number of years. I hope I'm not misspeaking here, but he's been on everything that I can recall. I just wanted to let you know that we have a forward-thinking director, and he is looking at and has established a program that helps hunters gain more access to private lands through this program, and we greatly appreciate that. The projects providing hunter access have accounted for 80% of the approved projects during 2003-2005 biennium. That's over 2 million acres of hunting opportunities provided on private lands. Hunting access was offered on private farms, ranches, and extensive tracts of industrial forest lands. So we've got a program in place that seems to be working. We've got money in the kitty. We are continually adopting projects, multiple projects for multiple years that provide hunter access. We believe that's the way to go. We don't think that there will be as much access as the proponents of this bill are stating, and that concludes my testimony, and Mr. Smith can talk to you about the rest.
Thank you, Chair Smith and the members of the committee, and thank you for having both of these bills here today so that I could talk about both of them without having to go to Salem. As Al mentioned, I'm a lifetime member of the Oregon Hunters Association and served as their president and chairman a number of years ago, back in the late 80s and early 90s. And I was also on the Access and Habitat Board, the statewide board, for the first 8 years of its existence, from 1993 to 2001. That experience gave me a very different and broader a view of the problems that landowners have, the problems and how they interact with problems that hunters see as well. And a number of solutions came up, some good and some not so good, I think, that the ANH board put forth. One of them was one that Mr. Mathers brought up a little bit ago regarding putting up fences around private lands. And I was part of that effort to put fences around some of the lands, private lands, that are suffering damage. And now I wish that I hadn't been, I think. I think I wish I would rather have looked for different solutions to the problem, because fences, yes, they're permanent, but they just move the animals somewhere else. And usually it's other private lands, and they're suffering the problems. And it's a never-ending problem that can't be solved, I think, with fences, at least, if wildlife are going to have a place at all. The intent of the LOP program was to alleviate damage and to help out landowners that are suffering damage from wildlife, and I agree with that. I see problems that landowners have had, and I've got to say that testifying against this proposed bill is difficult for me, in addition, because friends of mine are on the other side. I mean, Steve Mathers and Mike Crawford, that you listened to a little bit ago, are both good friends of mine, so I don't like to have to oppose something they want to do, but I think this bill isn't the right way to go about the problem. I think it creates more problems than it's going to solve. It converts the LOP program from one of trying to alleviate damage to one of just providing compensation, and I think it provides an incentive that's counterproductive to the program. I think you're going to have more landowners are going to try to sell their LOP tags. There's only about a third of them right now that are used, and I think much more of those are going to be used. And landowners are going to try to keep the animals on their land so that they have good hunting opportunities and can sell the tags for higher values. They would have the right to do that, but that's going to cause problems for adjacent landowners that don't have that opportunity, perhaps, to sell tags. And I don't think it's going to provide much in the way of increased access for public hunters. I mean, the tags primarily are going to be sold, I think. I mean, they may be given to family and good friends, but they're pretty valuable things, and they're not going to be just given to anybody. So they're going to be sold, and they're going to be sold for market values. They're going to be sold for thousands of dollars. And, yeah, there's a lot of hunters that can afford that or that will afford it, but An awful lot more don't. So it's yeah, maybe a little more access, but not for the general public hunter. If damage is the problem and public access is another problem to public access to private lands, then we ought to look for a way of solving those problems together. And you know, perhaps if landowners can sell all the tags that they're given, then maybe they'd be required to allow public access to a given number of hunters from a lottery system, not just to family and friends. I don't know if that's a workable thing, but it's something that would help increase the hunting pressure on private lands and help move those animals off onto public lands where they're much more easily dealt with. I mean, the Department of Fish and Wildlife pretty much can't manage animals on private lands. It's very difficult for them. I think they would tell you that. So I think there are other ways that we need to look other than what's in this bill to try and solve the problems.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
No. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ron Anglin from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Hi there, and thank you for being so patient.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I won't go through my testimony as you have a copy of it and you can read that, but I would like to address a couple of different things that came up and kind of reemphasize some things about the current LOP program or Landowner Preference Program. That if from a management perspective that the concern is addressing damage on a landowner's property, then you're talking about population control. And if you want to control the population, then you're talking about shooting antlerless animals. Antlerless animals, the tags for those can 100% be transferred to anybody the landowner's choosing. So when we're talking about the damage aspect, then there is a lot of flexibility within the program, and they can go to anybody the landowner's choosing. Those were amendments that were made to the legislation back in the mid-90s, and so far has been very beneficial to the landowners and has allowed them to more proactively address their problems. Additionally, for those that have an antlered bull tag, they decide not to use that because they are having damage, then those tags can be split 2-for-1, so each antlered bull tag can be split into 2 antlerless tags, and one of those antlerless tags can then go to somebody the landowner's choosing. The other one has to go to the landowner themselves. The department does have, as expressed before, some concerns about the bill, mainly because we feel that if you get more hunting pressure occurring from landowner preference, they tend to have a higher success rate on the private property than they do on public lands, and we are hunting on the same pool of available surplus animals during our seasons. And as hunter success goes up on private lands, more opportunity occurs on private lands, then we end up with less opportunity on public lands. And we're faced with two choices, either doing like we have had to do in a couple of units in Northeast Oregon in some of the bull hunts, restricting landowner preference opportunity to 10% of the total controlled hunt tags, or we have to reduce the public hunting opportunity on controlled hunts on public lands. So we really have few options available to us because we're dealing with a limited pool of animals. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and answer questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. Actually, a couple. So, as I understand your testimony, the department figures out how many elk or deer can be harvested in any particular year, and then has a percentage that they expect the take is going to give on any number of tags. So if you have LOP tags and you have regular hunting tags and so on, they figure out how many of each of those tags can be sold. And if this particular type, the hunting, the ability to harvest is greater, so that would reduce the number of tags in the others so that you don't end up over-harvesting.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, yes, what we're faced with is when we know, as an example, we have 100 animals that are available to be harvested in any particular hunt, then what we have to look at is what are the overall hunter success rates on those animals. And based on the information that we have right now, as an example, bull in either sex, Rocky Mountain and Roosevelt elk, LOP tags, they have a 28.9% success rate, and then the non-LOP tags or the public tags are an 18.2% success rate in 2003. So what we do then is, because LOP tags are guaranteed tags, we have to estimate how many LOP tags would be issued for that hunt. Based on that success rate, how many animals would they harvest? And from that, then, that leaves the number of animals that are left over. And based on the success rate that the public hunters have, we would calculate how many tags are offered for the public hunts. So if we see an increase in LOP opportunity and with a higher success rate on private lands than what we have on public lands, then we see a decrease in public opportunity tags.
Thank you. 28% success rate is based on the current system, which allows a third of the tags to be given out away. Do we know how many of the tags that are given, what the percentage is on those hunts? Or is it just LOP in general?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Right now, they and the LOP tags, the landowner preference, they can give a portion of them away or they can use them themselves.
That's correct.
Do we know those that are given away, what the percentage on those hunts is as opposed to the ones that they do themselves?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, no, we don't have that information.
So the 28 is the combined?
Yes, that's correct.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said that the number of landowner preference tags right now are guaranteed, and that's because we have this formula which is fixed based on the number of acres that, the owner owns. So when you say that this may have the effect of increasing LOP opportunity, that would only happen, we'd only have an increase in LOP opportunity if more people signed up their lands. Is that correct? I mean, because we're not issuing any more LOP tags based on, you know, if somebody owns 60,000 acres, they get X number of tags today, and they're going to get X number of tags tomorrow based on the rule. But if there's going to be an increase in LOP opportunity, what you're saying is there have to be more people signing up for it?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it could happen in two ways. The obvious way is if you get more landowners signing up and taking advantage of the system. The second way is if you have landowners that are not fully utilizing the LOP opportunity now, then say they only register for two of their seven tags or two of their five tags, then they would have the opportunity to go ahead and register for the remaining tags that their lands are qualified for and taking advantage of those. So there are two ways that the tag numbers could increase.
So you're saying if they could transfer all their tags, you're presuming that the rate of harvest would go up from 28% or whatever you said to perhaps 35%, which would then have the hydraulic effect on the public tags available through the controlled process.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I don't think that the landowner preference tag success rate would necessarily go up. Based over time and creating those averages, it appears to hover somewhere in the mid-20s. Seeing an increase in opportunity for non-family members to utilize those tags, we don't know at this time whether success rate would go up or not.
Follow-up. What I'm trying to understand is, and let's just presume that there's not going to be an increased number of acres signed up for the LOP program. If a person is entitled to 10 LOP tags today and they're entitled to those same 10 LOP tags tomorrow, I'm guessing that the Department of Fish and Wildlife says that's an acceptable level of harvest. And so it doesn't matter whether he shoots it or I shoot it or somebody comes in from Indiana and shoots the elk. I mean, and how does that have an effect on the tags available for the public?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it does not matter to the department who shoots the animal. And, you know, it's an opportunity. Really doesn't matter who has that opportunity. It what you get into is we do have lands that are not registered right now. An example was used earlier today from Wallowa County, the Boise Cascade lands in the Sled Springs unit. Very desirable elk population in it, some high-quality hunting opportunity. And if the program, LOP program, becomes attractive enough, it would be very easy for the owners of that property to decide to enroll in the landowner preference program and no longer offer public hunting opportunity like we offer today through our controlled hunt system. So in a case like that, you can have a large block of land for several hunts where tags could be available because the tags are available for each one of the controlled hunt types. Tags are available through the general archery season, uncontrolled for a landowner. So there can be multiple ways that you can see landowners enroll in the property that have not taken advantage of that in the past.
I have a question first. The privilege of the chair. Just to follow up on Representative Burley's question, are you saying then that you do the numbers on the controlled hunts by who's signed up or who's eligible?
Madam,
because it wouldn't matter on the Boise Cascade because they have 300,000 acres. They still get 10 tags. So,
Madam Chair, Okay. That's correct. They would qualify for the number of tags set on the acreage, but where they might offer a combination of 50 or 60 tags through the general archery season, the controlled deer hunt, the controlled first bull hunt, controlled second bull hunt, and have that all themselves through LOP, that could supplant the 2,000-plus tags that we offer right now through controlled hunts, through our access and habitat program, keeping those lands open.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Kind of a follow-up with that one as well. As I understood, also you were saying that we gave out in the total LOP elk tags 4,391, say last year. Now, that is not based on the chart you had. That's based on the actual ones that we gave out. And so a person may qualify for six but only ask for two. So they may be registered asking for two. So the potential on just those that are currently registered can grow if they decided to use them all. Is that what I'm...
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, that's exactly correct. And we're actually seeing that right now down in the Roseburg area where we're offering a whitetail deer hunt for the first time in many years. And we have landowners signing up for LOP tags that have never signed up before to the full extent possible and selling hunting opportunity for a fair sum of money.
Question? No? I think you've answered her questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'm sorry, there was another question I had.
Uh-oh, you didn't make it quick enough.
You mentioned in your testimony that you said one option, if this bill were to pass, may include to place a limit on the number of LOP tags available for elk hunts. And in parentheses, you say the department has already done this in several units in Northeast Oregon, but it may be necessary to expand this. In other words, you know, right now you've got this formula, number of acres, number of tags, and what you're saying is in some areas you're having to shift that up and down based on the number of animals available in various other things. How has that been received by the landowners in Northeast Oregon that have had their number of LOP tags reduced?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the ones that get their that participate in the draw every year and get their tags have been relatively happy with the program. Those that have not been successful in the draw have not been happy at all. On most years, it is worked out fairly close to everybody that applies has been able to get the tags. But we have had some years where some of the landowners, through their own special landowner preference draw, have not qualified and have not drawn the tags. But most years they have got their tags.
A follow-up, please. You just confused me on something. If I own 40,000 contiguous acres in Wallowa County, I get 8 tags according to the formula. I don't have to draw for those, do I? I get them.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, in those units in Northeast Oregon where we have the spike-only hunts and then the very special controlled bull hunt in the second season, or the either-sex hunt, we have a 10% cap on the number of LOP tags that are offered to landowners in those elk seasons. And basically what that means is landowners that register their land within those units go into their own controlled hunt draw for those 10% caps. If you see a reduction in elk numbers in that population or within that management unit, and you see less public hunting opportunity than the 10% cap, and you will see less landowner opportunity also. So the landowner can, right now, they have not been hurt by that, but there is the potential there to severely restrict landowners and their ability to have tags to hunt on their property.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative
Rogan? Oh, yeah. If you didn't have a cap in those hunts, there would not be any regular hunting caps. I mean, there wouldn't be any tags for the other hunter. Is that why you do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, there would be still be public hunting opportunity, but not at the level that we have today. We have some units where we approach 30% to 40% of the controlled hunt tags in a unit are actually LOP tags. But we've been able to so far keep that in balance.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
I bet you make a quick getaway this time. Have one more, Mark. Is it Rupert? Yeah.
Me.
That's you.
Again.
Now I know how to spell your name. Thank you very much.
Yes, my name is Mark Rupert. I'm a landowner in Cook County in the Maori unit. I was privileged to be a member of the ODF&W Management Objective Committee, along with Bill McCormick and Steve Mathers, who testified earlier. That committee covered the Ochko, Maori, and Grizzly units. It was comprised of landowners, hunters, guides, sportsmen in general, as well as having input from ODF&W. Some of the more interesting things that were uncovered in that committee and the discussions around it were that the vast majority of the animals are on private grounds. It doesn't matter how much public ground is out there, because in the Maori unit, probably 90% of the animals live on the minority of the lands that are private. Two main reasons. One, there's less pressure. On public ground, there's people recreating all the time, riding through. Hunter numbers are incredible. The other reason is better habitat on private grounds. The last testimony I gave touched on the fact that the public grounds hadn't been managed, or the timber clear cuts weren't there, that hasn't been burned. And on private grounds, they are managed to provide feed for cattle, whatever, whether it's alfalfa or rangeland. But the feed is in much better conditions. The animals realize that and flock to those better habitats. One of the things that we discussed in the Management Objective Committee was ways to increase the amount of animals on public grounds. The number one thing was to increase pressure on private grounds to force them off, make it uncomfortable for them there. They'll move back out. This tag allocation system would do that. We've got 9,000 acres. It's in two chunks. We get 4 tags we can give away per year if we desire to, but 4 guys aren't going to do much as far as moving animals off of 9,000 acres. If there was more people out there, they'd have more presence and they'd do more movement. Steve mentioned that the non-resident tags are not being used by the guides. Another pet peeve that came out, everyone testified universally the number of animals is dropped drastically in the last 10, 15 years. The reason management objectives are kind of pointless, especially for deer, because they're never hit. It doesn't matter how many you want out there, they can't get there. This will not impact that directly. If it indirectly, I believe it'll help. It should reduce the damage hunts. If we push more animals out, there'll be less damage. It'll also help compensate landowners for that use by the game, and provides an incentive for landowners to put up with the damage. If a guy can sell 5 tags instead of 2,
that's worth a whole lot of alfalfa being eaten by the elk. He might be a lot more tolerant of those elk in his alfalfa fields if he can get 2.5 times the income off of his tags. Nobody's mentioned that yet. One amendment I would like to you guys to think about and add would be that if a landowner did have landowner tags he was assigning and still had damage problems, that instead of giving him damage tags to give away, that those damage tags be required to be distributed through ODF&W, through a lottery, so that the public would have access to the antlerless hunts to control the populations that were causing the damage. That would make this thing a little bit more politically palatable to the general hunters, the Oregon Hunters Association, which I'm a member of. If you just give them more antlered tags, there's going to be a huge hue and cry. If you put this, you know, one amendment in place saying if they still have damage, we're not going to let them go out there and just massacre the animals. The public will get a chance at those animals. I know we're gone quite a ways over, so that's the. I'll make it cut it off there. One more plug,
okay,
that everybody agreed on would be the best way to increase opportunity for everyone combined would be to reduce predator populations.
Thought about that pilot.
That's it. I'd like to speak with you after the meeting.
Thank you very much. I don't see
any questions.
No, I don't see any. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2929. In committee, I think we've heard a lot of testimony today, and we need to have further discussions on this, and hopeful that the parties can get together and we'll bring this back. Thank you very much. With that, we're adjourned.
Okay.